Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Hey, so I'm here today with Sharon Rowe, the founder and CEO of EcoBags. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. You just gave a wonderful presentation at SOM for the Bright Lights Green Sights series. I learned a lot. For those few unfortunate people who are able to make the talk or see the live stream, can you tell us a little bit more about your background and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. It was great to be here and to give that talk, and I will fill in as many blanks as possible. My background actually is as an actress, and I was just telling people in the studio here that I auditioned at Yale about 35 years ago and failed to get in. So that sent me back to New York City, where I was working as an actress and taking various jobs, which got me to the point of, no, I don't want to do that anymore. And so I decided to start a company in 1989 called EcoBags. A lot of it was out of vision, and a lot of it was out of frustration. And another piece was just I wanted to make a right living doing good things.
Mm. Tell me more about that process, right? Because in 1989, to start an eco-friendly lifestyle brand in a lot of ways, what was that process like? Did you know what you were getting into, or how was that at
that
time?
I had no idea what I was getting into. I just started. I simply started. I said, I have an idea. I saw plastic bags, single-use plastic bags all over our neighborhood, getting stuck in trees, the gutter, in the river. I was living in upstate Manhattan, we called it. It's Washington Heights.
Oh, nice.
And I came home one day and said to my husband, and I had a newborn son, although he wouldn't have understood what I was saying at that point. I said, this has got to stop. This is crazy. We need to do something about this. I want to bring my own bags to the store. Mm-hmm. So I actually, through a number of steps, wound up getting some of the bags I was looking for, which were filet from France, and I had used them years earlier. They were these netted bags that could scrunch into your pocket, and I could bring them to the store and not bring home any of the flimsy plastic bags. And I noticed that when I was using them, other people were sort of watching me, and they were curious, and I thought, well, maybe I have a business here, and that's it. Yeah. I mean, there was no market for this.
Yeah.
Nobody was talking about it, except my husband and I, who sat down at the table and said, oh, okay, well, if you have a business, let's see, you need a name.
Yeah.
What should the name be? Huh. Okay, it's Eco. It's Bags. Eco Bags. And we put the two together. At that point, weren't thinking about branding. I don't know that I learned about branding until about 15 years in.
Oh, wow.
We saw a problem. I decided I could possibly make a living doing that.
Yeah.
It was a lot better than getting a job is what actors call other things that are not supporting, that support them, but they don't particularly like.
Yeah.
So I just set off on that path.
So what was the process in terms of, okay, this is a cool idea to, wow, this is turning into a business now?
Yeah. I think cool idea to business goes from no market to some market.
Okay.
When I started, I literally had to go door to door, and I did that on Amsterdam Avenue in Columbus in the city, because this is all pre-internet, pre-Google, of course. Some email. Fax was fashionable, and we'd have those rolls of fax paper all over our living room. But basically, it was human contact. So I would walk into stores and say, hey, I have this idea. Wouldn't it be great if, what do you think about it? And I got orders placed. So I had to fill the orders. And then I started filling more orders. And then I don't actually know how it happened, but the New York Post ran something about us, about reusable bags. It was probably in connection with Earth Day 1990, where we had a table.
Okay.
Well, that's what it was. We had a table at the Earth Day on 6th Avenue, and I had purchased some sum of bags. I can't remember, maybe $2,000 worth. And we sold everything. We sold out completely in 4 hours. So we thought, okay, people are interested in this. Of course, right next to us was the cloth diaper people. So it was that reusable market segment. And then we started sort of picking up orders. And then my husband ran into someone at a local natural food store. who was delivering goods and said, hey, and we're doing this, and this is, oh, cool. And it wound up being Stowe Mills, that was the company that preceded UNFI, which is now the largest natural products distributor in the United States.
Yeah.
And they placed a big order. So it just kind of happened. We might have just been there at the right time.
Yep.
But there really wasn't any market. It was niche is an overstatement.
Mm.
Niche is a huge overstatement. It was teeny, 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 teeny. And we'd even go to trade shows. The natural product shows seemed like a natural fit. Those are, you know, sort of progressive-minded people. And they were like, what? Well, what are you talking about? Reusable bat? What am I going to reuse it for? And we'd have to go into the whole conversation about plastic waste and blah, blah, blah. And this is before anything was really being reported on. So there were no statistics. It was just, do you notice when that bag breaks? Where does it go? Well, it doesn't go away. Well, it's not being recycled. Well, it's winding up in the park, et cetera.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, at least, you know, in the millennial age bracket, aren't really aware how much they were marketed to around reduce, reuse, recycle. You know, there was a time where those three terms weren't in the status quo. And there was a time before people didn't really have a work understanding of what happens to a plastic bag, nor did they care, right? So to really see that market early on in a way that, you know, and this is what I tell a lot of entrepreneurs all the time, make something that you would be interested in, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I say that too. Exactly. If it's a problem for you, it's a problem for other people.
Yep.
If it inspires you, it will inspire others because you are your market.
Yeah.
Now, the challenge is to expand beyond your core, which is you. But time takes care of that.
Mm-hmm.
Influence takes time of that, takes care of that. And I like to say a lot of times when I'll speak in front of groups that are more multi-generational than the one today, because everybody, when I asked, you know, do you bring your own bags to the store, they all raise their hands. I'll ask these questions. I'll say, do you bring your own bags to the store? And a lot of hands will go up. And I'll say, did you bring your own bags to the store 5 years ago? And fewer hands will go up. And I'll say, did you bring your own bags 10 years ago? And like one hand goes up. And I say, did you bring your bags 25 years ago? And usually that one hand is still up.
Yeah.
So
that one lifer.
That one person was the other person who also identified the same problem and wanted to address it at the same time maybe as I came out with my business. And somehow they found us.
Yeah.
We found them. We found each other.
Yeah.
And that's that microcosm that grew.
Yeah.
And started to tip the scale so that you weren't the weird one out in line.
Yeah.
You were the majority. And so now when people, in some areas, not everywhere, and certainly, yeah, it's still not everywhere.
Yeah.
And the thinking doesn't go beyond the bag. We have to go beyond the bag.
Yeah. Let's get back to the story. So UNFI, right, puts in a big order.
Yeah.
And then what happens next?
Well, then we start going to the natural product stores, and we start serving a lot of the natural product stores that are also served by UNFI, either directly or through them, like Park Slope Food Co-op. They've been around for 30-plus years. Commodities Natural Foods, Cambridge Natural Foods up in Cambridge. I mean, there's thousands and thousands of natural product stores. And then we started selling to Wild Oats, and I think Wild Oats got purchased by Whole Foods, because then Whole Foods came out. They were tiny. Then they grew. And then, though, the market for it went way beyond just natural product stores. That's only one segment of what we do, which is putting products into stores. It started becoming part of a branding process where stores wanted their names on bags.
Mm.
That actually happened pretty early on. So we started printing on bags. And then when you start printing on bags just for stores and your label's on the bag, then you get Citizens Committee for Justice, you get Earth Lab, you get other brands that want bags. You get, I could run reports for days.
Yeah.
But we have natural products resellers. We have WNYC, we've been selling bags to for years.
Radio Lab, right?
Yeah, I don't know if we do Radio Lab. I'll say sure, yes. one of them. I know we do 3 or 4 different bags for them.
Yeah,
but so you get different entities coming to you, organizations, profit, for profit, not profit, whatever. And you get events, you get conferences, because all of a sudden now you're crossing over into the promotional arena.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you when that giant woke up, though, was when the reusable bag market woke up, which for us was when our bags went on Oprah because it was Oprah's Earth Day segment, and Oprah has influence.
Yeah.
Thank you, Oprah.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Oprah, for a variety
for
of
so
things.
Many
so,
things.
So many
so
things.
Many
so
things.
Many things.
Yeah. So, I mean, even Time Magazine didn't have the kind of expansion that Oprah gave us.
Yeah.
And all the, again, all she did was point to our bag.
Yeah.
She pointed. You know,
have you met Oprah yet?
No, I haven't.
Wow.
I would love to. Let this be a call.
Yeah,
for Oprah.
I'll shoot her a text or something. Okay. We can try to set something up.
Because, you know, because before it even happened, I didn't know even about her show. I just was following other people who had been following her show because I'm a working person. So I work all day. And this is before, I keep saying this, but this is before DVRs and, you know, internet TV, smart TV. This is when you actually had to watch a show because it was on at 4.
Yeah.
I've never been home at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, so even when I had a home office, I wasn't, you know, turning the TV on. But anyway, when the market woke up, all these outliers, all these other manufacturers that had been doing blank items, stock goods that you can imprint with your brand, said, oh, right, we've got reusable bags. Mm. And then the market became actually really flooded with everybody calling what they were doing a reusable bag, because it is a bit of an oxymoron. If it's a bag and it's built to last, it's reusable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not a single-use plastic bag, but it's reusable. The challenge was that the promotional market that woke up, that we now found ourselves in, and serving customers and happily serving customers who wanted to co-brand with us, not only because of the reusable aspect of the bag, but because of the values behind it and the responsible supply chain. And we can talk about all that later. But those people who broke into the market who were purely promotional were still upset that they couldn't have BPA on things. I mean, they hadn't woken up to the environmental issues and the social issues around fair trade and fair wage and responsible sourcing, but they saw the opportunity for reusable bags. So they, you know, we got flooded, the market got flooded, and still very, very populated with like fossil fuel, bags that are made from fossil materials. Nonwoven polypropylene is fossil-based. It's a woven synthetic, you know. So in those bags, they last, they can be used as reusable, but what happens with them when you're done with them?
So
there's so many issues. I mean, and when we started, we just instantly started like, oh, let's do these little cotton string bags from France. Filet, and in you know, in Russia they call them a voska, just in time, and in Spanish countries they call them bolsa. You know, and in Israel, they have another term for them. But, you know, everybody knows it. And I've met people who said, oh, my grandma used to make those. So, you know, like anything in America, it gets complicated.
Yeah. And let's dig a little bit more into those complications, right? So it's really interesting to me to think that at one time, people didn't really understand the importance of, okay, reusable bags, right? And not only that, as a reusable bag as a simple product, but the environmental benefits behind that, right? And I think one thing I really appreciate about your company is that you don't only take the importance of the environmental aspects of a reusable bag in and of itself, right? You're saying, okay, what are the fair wage, fair trade, and really responsible supply chain management skills that we can put into all elements of our business? Can you talk about your intention behind those and how you really built that up?
Yeah, sure. That's sort of been baked in since the very beginning. I don't really know where it came from still. It just was an awareness that I had that if I'm going to solve a problem, which was the single-use plastic problem, and build a movement called Cleaning Up the Planet One Bag at a Time that would inspire people to think about not only the bag they use, but the things they put in the bag and really consider their environment, that the tool that they were using, carrying around, feeling good about, because so much about that is you have to feel good about what you're doing, you know, marketing 101. I couldn't have that made in a sweatshop.
Yeah.
I couldn't have a benefit appear here that was harmful there, wherever there was, whether it was another city or, you know, in the U.S. or, you know, halfway around the world. I just knew that that was important, as well as sourcing materials, like, so that fair wage, fair trade thing goes all the way to the beginning, to the farmer who puts the seed in the soil, to the way the ground is tilled, the whole thing.
Was that challenging for you in the beginning in terms of getting investment or getting a better idea of how to grow your business, even though you had such environmental, social, and really economic principles within your company?
Yeah. I'd say it was challenging in that I didn't even know there were no certifications back then, or there weren't any certifications that I was aware of.
Yep.
So my first deep dive into this, even though I had it as thinking and I had it as an integral part of what we were doing, was when I got into organic cotton. And I got into organic cotton in, I think, oh gosh, it could have been 2000 or 2001, so really early. And I got into it because the manufacturer that I had partnered with and still am partners with in Mumbai, outside of Mumbai, we were having conversations about it. And he was working with people in Europe who were really interested in it, because Europe is way, way ahead of the U.S. in terms of azo-free dyes, organic cotton, which they call bio. So I actually got to get on the train on that one.
Yeah.
I mean, I already had it in my mindset. I was already pursuing it. I'd already had conversations about it. But I didn't know anybody in the U.S. that was doing it. But I knew people overseas who were doing it and who were already working with these considerations and taking them seriously.
Yeah. Wow. So then as you grow, have you found that that's been hard to scale?
Well, it goes with market, right? So scale, no. From my point of view, scale market, yeah. Because so we introduced organic cotton in like I think it was 2000, because we did an organic trade show in Chicago. I'm trying to remember. And it didn't go very well. We had towels and napkins and bags. And we found out that our buyers wanted organic cotton, but they didn't want to pay for it. And we even, with our margins, the way we set our margins up is we actually sliced our margins so that on the organic goods, we were making smaller margins than on anything else. We found, because we thought, let's take the market, let's not go in at a premium, because the premium thing doesn't seem to be working. Let's go in where it's affordable and competitive with other products. And we had three types of fibers we were primarily working with. We did organic cotton, recycled cotton, and conventional. Now, conventional we used to call natural. It's either way, you can call it natural, conventional. It's a little of a misnomer. Actually, recycled is too. Natural, what's natural? I mean, we were saying it's natural, meaning the color is natural and it has no special attributes. It's cotton. And yeah. By the way, we started before Monsanto and all of that stuff that started.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave that one alone. So we had these three fibers, but people understood already recycled. Even though, like you said, millennials, reduce, reuse, recycle. Recycle's the third word.
Yeah.
Now, there are reasons why recycled got a lot of play. A lot of it has to do with recycling in the United States and corporate interests behind it.
Huh.
I actually don't want to go into that right now.
Okay,
you look it up yourself. Google
fair.
It.
Google it.
But then there's also well-meaning programs, too. But the focus has always, from an environmentalist standpoint and a conservationist point of view, on conservation, which is reduce. First you reduce what you're using, then you reuse, and then you recycle.
Okay.
So in terms of how that played out with fiber and markets is people wanted recycled goods, basically. They wanted it to say recycled.
Yeah. So how did you bridge that gap?
Well, what we did is we just changed up our mix.
Okay.
We changed our stock mix.
Yeah.
And even to this day, our stock mix has changed. We have people, though, who are fervently all organic. That's all they'll buy. So we manage the stock for them. We have people who come in and will choose between organic, recycled, and natural. And we have people who only want natural, which we now call conventional. Sometimes it's just because of the size of the bag. And sometimes they want only recycled. Now, what we're doing right now, though, because I want to make sure not only for the type of fiber, because organic cotton is certified, seed to sown, everything, every step of the way, which includes all the social aspects. I realized that our conventional cotton didn't have that. And there really was no way to have it until I literally stumbled upon this thing called the Better Cotton Initiative. So what I've done now is I have a directive with my partners to only source from BCI cotton. So what BCI cotton is cotton that has the fair wage, fair labor stamp on it from seed to sown.
Okay.
And that's because, you know, cotton is a huge agricultural product, and it's a huge agricultural product all over the world. And in India, you know, there's reports that children are made to work in the fields, et cetera, et cetera. So we want to make sure that anybody who works in is, you know, age appropriate, compensated well, et cetera, et cetera, all the way up the food chain.
Absolutely.
And that's, so we're right now we're looking at BCI. I hope that's what proves out.
And you visited one of those partners,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I've been to the organic cotton, and I've been to the conventional, and I've been everywhere from picking cotton, all the way up to seeing all the nets woven. I've been in major league factories. I mean, they go on for football fields.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then I've also been where we do a lot of just, you know, because you buy thread, and then you make the thread into fabric. So I've seen every step of the process, actually.
Wow.
Many times.
What was the most surprising part of it?
I don't know, surprising, but one of the more joyful parts of it is that the organic, where we source organic, it's a cooperative, so there's schools, there's housing.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You can just tell from meeting the people that it's a good environment. And it's a well thought out environment. And these people who are doing the organics, they never switched to conventional. They didn't have to go back.
Yep.
You know, because there's a time when you have to go, well, you know, from coffee, there's a time when you have to leave the field and let it transfer. So they never had to do that.
Wow.
And that's actually, I mean, there's a lot of things about organic in other than cotton, other than fibers, which is really challenging. Because who can leave their fields fallow for how long, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the joys was going to the schools, meeting with the principals, seeing happy kids. You know, I'm a mom. And, you know, knowing that there are other people out there who are stewards for this and are making their living, their life, without negative impact or with minimal negative impact and that it can be done.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's so good. Again, there's so many different facets of your business that I enjoy. But another part is how, even though, so you understand the entire process of your supply chain, right? And you want to have it, I think, imbued and really ingrained into the DNA of your business are these ethical practices. But even with that, you've chosen really intentionally to stay small.
Yeah.
For the most part, can you really tell us, like, did you start with that idea of saying we're going to do something beautiful and just keep it small and be very intentional in how we build it?
No, I don't think so. I think because when we started, there was no market size. Mm. We couldn't say, oh, we want to be the next Kleenex. We want to be the next whatever.
Wow,
there were no comps. We were in the wild, wild west. There was no one else doing what we were doing. Actually, that's not true. Let me back up. That first Earth Day on 6th Avenue, I noticed that there were two people watching what we were doing. And at the end, I said, hi, you're watching everything we're doing. And they were like, yeah, I'm Lainey. This is Ken. We're doing something kind of similar. And I said, okay, let's work together.
Oh, great.
I mean, isn't that you know. And then moving forward, you know, there's a number of other brands that we've sort of said, well, let's work together. Instead of, I could have made their stuff like this.
Yeah.
I mean, I could have, it's not hard. Not, this is not rocket science.
Yeah.
So, but to stay small, it's been intentional. We had a huge ride after the Oprah thing. I have to say we grew 3 times. The millions were there.
Wow.
And the recession kind of knocked us back to reality. And I'd be remiss to say, oh, everything's really groovy. It's since that recession took the wind out of a lot of our sales. Luckily,
wow,
not all our sales. We were resilient enough to get back, you know, to be sturdy enough and to continue to grow. I know a lot of companies that went completely out in that recession. So it's kind of combined with my age, too, which I won't give away. Nobody can see me, so they probably think I'm a millennial, too. But I realized I could... I've always... This is one thing. This is actually a very good point. I look at how much effort it takes to grow how much. And if it's not measurably more,
yeah,
I'm not going to make the effort.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I'm not looking to work 10 extra hours a week to get a slight bump.
Yeah. Yeah. They said, a study said that after 70K in income, then really it's a very small marginal increase in happiness, right? And I think for a lot of businesses out there, it's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can get to a point where, okay, you're taking care of your staff, you're feeding yourself, feeding your kids, you're taking care of your local community, everyone in your supply chain, everyone who interacts with your business is happier. Then why really throw yourself over the edge just to get that marginal increase, right?
Yeah.
Instead,
yeah,
why don't you just go back and see, okay, is there any way that what the small thing or that we're doing right now, can we be more innovative, more effective in the space that we're already in?
Yeah, exactly. Like that. You know, I totally, and so that's where I got this idea for Tiny Business. And I am working on a book called Magic of Tiny Business.
Okay.
And the idea is that you can be very intentional with what you want. You can imagine the size you want to be. I mean, actually, it's helpful to know that. I think in some ways I limited my size because I thought, oh, I only want to go this big or this big. And I blew myself out of the water several times.
Oh, wow. Good.
But the key thing is to understand that, like, it's like a plant or a tree. It's got a certain amount of energy in it, and it can grow to a certain point. But a tiny business is more like a bonsai.
Oh, wow.
So you can train it. Because you really do have the power. So if somebody comes to me and says, I want 100,000 bags, blah, 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 and I need them to be 97 cents. Well, I'm not that. I am not going to twist myself into a pretzel, have to go and you know, completely find a new supply chain or haggle down my current supplier to the point we're all making, you know, percentages of a penny,
yeah,
to get that person that thing. I'm actually more willing to say, we don't do that.
Mm.
Here's what we do do.
Yeah.
And I can get you what you want at that thing, but it's going to cost you $1.79.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just making numbers up.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times the pressure comes from its price pressure. And what price pressure is telling you to do is we need you to be more competitive. But sometimes you want to be cooperative.
Mm.
You don't want to be competitive.
Yeah. And that seems like it's been a theme throughout your entire business.
Yeah.
Whether it's partnering with people who you see at the Earth Day, right? Or it's partnering with other brands across the country.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of quotes come across my desk, in our desk, where we're like, no. Because saying no is as important as saying yes.
Yeah, say that again for the people in the back who didn't hear you.
Saying no is as important as saying yes. And I think maybe it only comes with maturity, and maturity only comes with really hashing it out a lot, and maybe, you know, good days and bad days. And you win some, you lose some. But in the end, what's the long-term gain?
Mm.
I mean, I can go on record with our most recent president, Obama. One thing I admired about him, even when I didn't agree with a policy decision, is I could tell that he was thinking really far out.
Yeah.
He wasn't just reacting to what was in front of him that day or even in a year. He had a very long-range vision. And I kind of think with like a bonsai, getting back to that metaphor, you can train your business, but you're training yourself too for what you want.
Yeah.
Or not want. Like I always wanted a lot of vacation. I mean, I'll come right up and say it. I wanted a lot of vacation time.
Yeah.
I wanted to spend time with my family and my kids.
Yeah. One thing, there's a venture company called Collaborative Fund based out of New York that I personally really enjoy. And they said, aim to be around for 100 years and not make 100 million, right? And really ensure the longevity and the intentionality of your business in ways that don't have to do with price, right? Or don't have to do with revenue. But really, why are we here? Why are we doing it? And what do we have to offer the next 100 years?
Right. 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 And make it livable and profitable for you, because yeah. Otherwise you have nothing to send. I actually think it's a reinvention of Main Street.
Hmm.
Right? I mean, you go down any Main Street right now. I know in my town, Ossining, you go down the Main Street, a lot of stores are shut or there's new ones kind of struggling to survive. You know, when I was growing up, my dad had a store. He had a store in Bloomfield, Connecticut. It was next to other small stores. You know, somebody once asked me, oh, he had a business. I said, no, he had a store.
Wow.
You know, a store. Well, that store was around for a long time, and so were the other stores around. And they all provided a decent living for their families. And, you know, the coffee shop on the end, actually, it was owned by Greek families that would come in rotation. And as soon as they made enough, they would go back to Greece and, you know, have a wonderful life. And I think we need to repopulate Main Street. It may not be bricks and mortar Main Street. Or maybe bricks and mortar Main Street that has internet presence, whatever. I mean, the form of it, but the idea that you can build, you can have influence from a tiny business. You can have influence from a tiny business. And you can serve yourself and serve your community and add value, because I think that's the key thing. You said it. You have to be able, if you're not adding value, what are you doing?
Yeah, and just not economic value either.
Yeah. What are you doing? I had a young man come up to me at a party recently. He was actually a classmate of my daughter's in high school. And he came up, and I've heard this actually from a number of people. And, of course, I was like, yay. But he came up to me. He goes, you know, I've been trading now for 3 years, and it's soulless. You know, and I said, so what do you want to do? And he said, I don't know. I need to make a living. I mean, you cannot discount that piece.
Absolutely.
I mean, people who don't come from wealth, we need to make a living. So you have to find the way to do that where you also feel good about what you wake up in the morning to do.
Yeah. And I think going back to your previous point about, you know, I can agree with you more. We need to really reinvent Main Street, right? And really start creating value for ourselves and the people that we want our businesses or companies or products to interact with. And you touched on this a number of times during conversations, and I feel like the next iteration of that could be a B Corp. Can you tell us a little bit more about the B Corp movement and why you're really excited about it?
Sure. Well, we've been a B Corp since 2011. We had a lot of the same thinking even prior, so we just brought it forward. The B Corp is really, it's about people, planet, and profit. I like to add passion and persistence.
Oh, nice.
So it's a group of business people that are focused on solving today's problems through business, which is different than solving today's problems through nonprofits.
Mm.
These are businesses for good. I'm not saying anything negative about nonprofits. I actually sit on the board of two. But this is, you know, business acumen can work really well in tangent with a value proposition to fix a problem. And everybody can share in the benefit of it. That's a win. That's a win-win-win.
Yeah, I'd say so.
You know, and I mean, we're still small. I've actually looked into what do you call it? I'm forgetting what it's called. ASOPs and stuff like that. But we're actually still even tiny for that.
Oh wow!
But the companies that do that, but maybe that's one way. The other way is solving the problem, make sure everybody's compensated as well as you can. Again, you can't go forward if there's no gas in your tank.
Yeah. And that's something they don't tell you enough.
No.
You know?
And B Corps put people together, B corporations. So all these people sign up to be a B Corps. You have to be vetted. It's a really long form, but it's surmount. You can do it. If I did it, you can do it, because I really don't like forms. And it puts you in a community of like-minded people who, I'll do a plug for Brian Welch, who has a magazine out now called Be the Change Media.
Okay.
It's a platform and there's a magazine. So you get into a community of people who are like-minded in terms of doing, adding value, doing good. And you get energy from that. And you get ideas. And you do business with them. And so on a day-to-day basis, it's not abrasive. It's positive. It's not a hassle. It's a look forward to. You get on the phone with somebody. It's like, hey, you know, wow, I'm so happy. And also, a lot of the things that at least I was taught as a woman in business, you know, I could touch on that for a minute, but it's all these conventions that you're supposed to do. Well, you know what? You don't have to.
Yeah.
You do not have to. You know, a long time ago, I said, if Steve Jobs can wear, you know, a black T-shirt and jeans to every meeting, then I am not wearing suits anymore. This is not necessary.
Yeah, yeah.
Who am I trying to impress anyway?
Yep, yep. And I honestly don't think enough young business owners realize that they are the owner of their business. Right?
Yes.
And not what society dictates an owner of a business should be.
Right.
And actually, leading into that, can you tell us kind of your company culture and how you, as being a woman entrepreneur, has since 89 has really shaped your view about business in general?
Yeah, you know, I have to say I didn't have much of an idea about business before I started it, so I wasn't handicapped.
That's a great point.
I came to business as an actress, and I came to business as an improviser, which I think works for me personally, but didn't always work for my organization, because I can move from one thing to the next with lightning speed and go, oh, that works. Okay, that works too. Okay, that works too. Okay, well, what are we supposed to do? I don't know. Pick one. So that's not good for linear thinking people.
Yeah.
But what I've tried to do, and hope I've done a good job, and I guess when I get back to the office, everybody will tell me, is be as open and honest as possible. And my goal has always been to create as much value in terms of compensation and in terms of the environment as I can in the office.
Mm.
And as I can is in quotes, because I have to watch as, you know, I work with my CFO, you have to watch that bottom line.
Yeah.
I mean, basic business rules apply. So you just have to watch the bottom line so that you can be effective. That's it. You have no message if your corner gets taken away.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love how you really just keep touching back on the fact that, yes, you want to be environmentally friendly. Yes, you want to be socially friendly. Yes, you want to have a good company culture. But also, we need to feed the people that we work with, right? Whether it's the people in India actually picking the cotton and really giving you your product that you can then add the value to and sell. Everyone on the supply chain needs to be able to be compensated appropriately. And a lot of times, I think, especially when we're talking about social enterprise and B Corps, a lot of people liken it a bit too much to nonprofits. But no, we're really saying we want to leverage tried and true business principles to create social value across the world.
Yeah, yeah. And you just have to know your market. I mean, some things you can mark up more, and some things you have to keep, you know, tinier margins on. And the market will tell you if it's working.
Yeah.
I mean, you will get a resounding no cash register rings if it doesn't work. I mean, the thing about the whole supply chain, we're just making a movie of that too. So,
oh.
And I hope to share it if you come to my website.
What's your website?
EcoBags, ecobags.com. We're just transitioning now to a responsive site, so it's not quite there, but we will be putting a video on in the next, let's say, few months that will show the supply chain and everybody we work with, because it's not just our manufacturing partners overseas. It's the printers that we work with in West Haven, Connecticut for 20 years.
Wow.
It's the warehouses that we have. We have a couple of them. It's our customs brokers and lawyers and CFO. And what I've done is I've always used like other companies. So we have sort of like a system, a planetary system.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was a choice, because I didn't want to be the boss of many.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing that also goes to Tiny. I wanted to keep it manageable.
Yeah, and nimble, right? So you can be able to make those iterations and transitions that a bigger company might be sluggish in making.
Yeah.
That's a great point. One thing you said also in your talk that I, again, really enjoyed was when you're talking about your, like, going to Mumbai, right, and seeing the airport in India and seeing all the different ways in which you have such beautiful, beautiful land and opportunity and equipment that people are building this, their product with.
Mm-hmm.
You said no infrastructure. They had no infrastructure to undo and only opportunity to create, right? And that's so beautiful when you're thinking about the ways in which developing countries really operate off of the mistakes of developed countries, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And I feel like we have the opportunity with social enterprise, right? And the sector that we're in to really build something off the backs of what a lot of people might seem as a platform that didn't quite, a society or a method that didn't quite work as effectively as we would have hoped.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the first chapter in this book that I am writing, The Magic of Tiny Business, is actually, if you don't know exactly what you do want, I bet you know exactly what you don't want.
Mm.
And the don't want comes from just what you said, seeing the examples of what you don't want to do.
Yeah.
I don't want to work in X. I don't want to be that kind of person. I don't want to have 2 weeks off vacation every year.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to have to put my dog in doggy day. And whatever.
Yeah,
you know, it's like a million things, but you know your don'ts. And you don't can't always create it so you have everything you want. But if you can create a list of mostly what you don't want, and you know of some of what you do want, at least you know where you're steering the ship. I mean, you'd never get in your car and just go, okay, where?
Yeah.
Where do you want to go?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, or even, you know, in Manhattan, you go for a walk. Sometimes you're going to the grocery store, but along the way, you see people you know. You know, there's an ecosystem there that you have to acknowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a good point. And I think even when you're building out the ecosystem, it can be one, again, that helps everyone, right? And that really benefits everyone in a way that, okay, well, you, and goes back to your initial point about partnerships and the way you partner with people, right? Making sure that when you're going around and building your business, you're taking other people on the ride too. And that's amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember when I was not even a little girl, even in my 20s, I mean, you would go into a store and someone would say, can I help you? And the person who would help you would know where all the different things came from, or would help you get, you know, put things on, would help you with outfits or whatever. I don't know if they knew where it came from manufacturing wise, because that's so much newer.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if people who are way younger than me know that that even existed, because we tend to now, if you even shop, well, I mean, who even goes into stores now, right?
Yeah.
You go on Amazon, and so, or you go into these large big box stores and you have to find the sneakers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or whatever. It's all help yourself. But there's something missing in that, because one large entity, like if you go into a large big box store, one buyer is buying for that category across 1,000 stores.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've lost balance here. I'm not saying that's all bad, but I'm saying that can't be the only thing, aside from all the economic parts of that that don't work.
Yeah. But as you said, going back to B Corps, there's other influences and externalities that we can compute in creating value aside from the financial and economic, right?
Yes. And it's picking up, particularly because of millennials, because people are looking at packaging, they're reading where things came from, they're wanting to know, here's the key thing, people now, and I'm not calling them consumers very deliberately, people, citizens, want to know where, what's the story? You know, especially since you can have on either a daily or weekly basis some small pleasure. And that small pleasure can be derived from something as simple as having a soap.
Yeah.
In your bathroom. Maybe you bought it for, I don't know, $2, $3, for, but you know it, the story behind it.
Yeah, I'm a big soap guy too. So
me too,
to
yeah.
Me.
I love
a good soap.
There's something about just these, it's a small moment, it's a small cost.
Yeah, but you just appreciate it so much.
Yeah. I bet you're into beans, too. I love beans. Oh, like,
yeah.
Like, really
yeah.
basic foods, and you know where they came from, you know who grew them, and yep. oh my gosh, you can make the best, the tastiest meals.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. And I think going, this is interesting, too, because in the talk you gave earlier today, you talked about how, you talked a lot about self-care, right, mm-hmm. and how important that meeting with yourself is. So as you're busy and as you're trying to create value and building your company and writing your book, how do you really find time for yourself and have those grounding moments?
Yeah. The answer I would give for that is I don't find time, I make time.
Mm.
So I actually have restarted a meditation practice in the morning, mostly because I'm going away for a meditation retreat this summer where you have to sit for 40 minutes to an hour and I have to flex that muscle. It isn't that easy. And then in terms of, I mentioned in the talk, I swim a lot. I'm a swimmer. It's a little harder now in the winter when it's just so cold. So to get to that pool, even if it is indoors, it's just bracing. I make it. I put it on my calendar. I block it out and I don't let things bump into it. Although I have to say, there's always a caveat, right? Yesterday, I blew through my swim time to write my talk today at Yale. Because I thought, no, I really should not show up unprepared.
Well, it was a great talk. Really appreciate it.
I really needed to put some thought into it. So it's not like always. I think that's also important, too, is there's no rigidity around this.
Yeah.
It's just in general, self-care is really important because you can't do what you need to do unless you're healthy.
Yeah. Wow. So the people listening, how can they get involved? How can they learn more about EcoBags and your book and your movement and everything that you're doing?
Well, EcoBags is easy. EcoBags.com. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. What we love is if you use our brand or you shop reusably or you have ideas about creating less waste, share it with us on Instagram because we'll repopulate. It doesn't have to be specific to our brand either.
Oh, wow.
I mean, we like to just, it's all about messaging and shifting shifting culture.
Yeah.
Even, you know, if you go somewhere, here's a good thing. I don't know if it's on our website, but you could always contact us. I have a form letter called Pick It Up, Point It Out. If you're anywhere in the world and you are just cannot stand the amount of plastic trash on where you are on the at the beach, we found that writing letters to the editor is a really effective grassroots way. And this is a form letter saying, hey, you know, I was lying here. It was beautiful, but I found 372 pieces of microplastics. We should do something about this. I actually did that a long time ago on Martha's Vineyard. The other way is I have a webpage called The Magic of Tiny Business that might migrate to a new name. So, and you can just look for us. We're around a lot. And we're in stores. I think we're in a store in New Haven, actually. I wish I remember the name of it. I'm sorry.
No problem. Let me know and I'll add it to the description.
Yeah, or use our bags for conferences because I think objects tell stories. We tell stories. The more you can engage on a story, the more brands are recognized, the more their stories come forward. And ours isn't one just for self-gain. This is really for a cultural shift to have people think more deeply about who we are, where we are now, and if not now, when? You know, when can you make that shift?
Wow, great parting words, Sharon. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We really appreciate your time.
Enjoyed this. Thank you.
Have a good one.